Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Rick Trainer. I'm rector of Exeter College, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to this extraordinary Exeter College Rector Seminar. We're very pleased indeed to have as our speaker this evening the Honorable Kevin Rudd, who has had, I think, to put it mildly, a very remarkable career. He was educated first at Australian and National University, where he took a first in Chinese studies. He went on to further training at the Mandarin Training Center in Taipei. And of course, we know him best now for his political career, but he had a significant career before he went into politics. As a diplomat for Australia, including time at the embassies in Stockholm and Beijing, he was a political staffer and a public servant in Australia before he was elected to the House of Representatives in Australia in 1998. After that, his rise was truly meteoric, leader of the Australian Labor Party from 2006, prime minister between 2007 and 10, and again in 2013, and in between that, foreign minister of his country. And of course, he had a very notable period as Prime Minister of Australia, landslide victory in 2007, a justly celebrated success in helping his country cope with the worldwide financial crisis, a famous apology on behalf of the Australian people to Indigenous Australians, important digital and educational initiatives, and adhering to the Kyoto Protocol, which in a period in which some national leaders make headlines by breaking their country's adherence to environmental protocols is something that we ought to take special note of, I think. But of course, he's also had a lot of distinguished activity since he left politics in 2013. In 2014, he was a senior fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School. Between 2014 and 16, he was chair of the Independent Commission on Multilateralism. And since 2015, his main job has been as the inaugural president of the Asia Society's Policy Institute in New York. He has distinguished affiliations to Chatham House in London, to the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, to the Paulson Institute in Chicago, and to Tsinghua University, which of course is in Beijing. But I think in some ways the most remarkable aspect, not of his whole career certainly, but of his activity since 2013, is the fact that, like many people in this room, he's currently a DPhil student in the University of Oxford. Now, the only thing we in Exeter College have against him is that he's chosen to enroll at our traditional rival across Turtle Street, Jesus College. Happily, these days, we have a warm and productive relationship with Jesus College, so we can easily forgive him that. But seriously, I think it's a wonderful comment on a distinguished statesperson that having left politics and taken on all these distinguished appointments, that he thinks it worthwhile to earn an Oxford doctorate, for which his subject is the worldview of Chinese President Xi Jinping. So for all sorts of reasons, I know we're all looking forward to hearing Kevin Rudd talk to us on a subject which is of importance to us all: how dangerous are current threats to liberal democracy? Please join me in welcoming him to this rector seminar.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's good to be back at Oxford, and good to be here at Exeter. For a college that's 700 years old, the building holds up pretty well. I'm sorry about Turtle Street and which side I ended up, but I gather, having read a little bit about the history of Exeter, that you began, I think, with a benefactor who was then the Bishop of Exeter, if that's right, who, if I've read it clearly, was also treasurer to Edward II. And so your college has been dedicated since then to Mammon, across the other side of Turtle Street, at Jesus College, we're dedicated to God. At least that's our line, and we're sticking to it. Mind you, if you've been Prime Minister of Australia and you're given the opportunity of having a new email address, which is kevin.rudd@jesus, it's hard to resist. I'm very happy about that. I can't speak for Jesus. I think him owning politicians with the same mailbox, I think, would be a problem. Rick asked me tonight to speak not on my normal subject, which is what the hell's going on in China and what does it mean for the rest of the world, but instead to speak on challenges to the future of liberal democracy. I will give it my best shot. I speak, therefore, not as an academic, not as a political scientist, but as a political practitioner and someone who's experienced the highs and lows of political life, but someone who deals a lot with, let's call it, the international political class still today, and the challenges, the real challenges, which lie at the coalface and what we can do about it. And so the questions I'd like to open with you this evening are along these lines. When we speak of democracy, what are we actually talking about? And is the idea itself worthy of defending for the 21st century? This is a conversation which in the last century, or at least in its second half, would never have occurred. But it's probably important to revisit the fundamentals of the question, given the scepticism I now see in many parts of the collective West. What is the idea, and is it worth defending? Now, the second question which I'll seek to address this evening is, so what the hell's gone wrong? And if we seek to stand back from the tumult, what actually are the structural forces at work against this thing we call the contemporary democratic project, and where it fits within what we would call the wider fabric of the idea of the West? And finally, what then shall we do? What then can we do to answer Lenin's perennial question, although in relation to a project which Lenin did his best to destroy? So what's this idea of democracy, and where does it come from? Everyone in this room, friends of Exeter College or members of the college, will know their Greek, they'll know their Latin, they'll know its ancient antecedents. Periclean Athens and the rest. Well, that's fine, except that Periclean Athens was essentially a male oligarchy. Let's be very clear about that. And then if we roll on 1,500 years or so, the much celebrated Florentine Republic, the Venetian Republic, even the Dutch Republic, were larger male oligarchies than the original Athenian male oligarchy. It is really not until the 19th century we begin to see the essence of what we have described as an emerging wide franchise across people not simply qualified on the basis of being A, male, or B, having property. And in fact, it's not until 100 years ago precisely that that includes the female franchise as well. This is, I would submit to you, therefore, a very recent adornment in the history of civilization, and very recent within the matter of the last several generations. And therefore, when we contemplate its future, we should be therefore very mindful of how delicate its past has been, and those who have shed blood, sweat, and tears in the extension of the democratic process and the democratic franchise over the decades and centuries which have preceded us. Its emergence, of course, has been part of a wider civilizational construct. As someone who has spent most of his life studying the history of East Asia, I can faithfully report to you that there is nothing parallel to the emergence of liberal democracy in either 19th or early 20th century East Asia. It was not on the cards. It was, in fact, a radically different set of political premises which applied in those cultures, countries, and wider civilizational constructs. And so in the West, however, if you go to the deeper origins of the idea of what we now call happily the modern demos. It comes out of ideas of the intrinsic dignity of humankind. It comes out of ideas that we can have something approaching a civil polity which can deal with the conflicting interests which beset the state or the society at a given time, and to do so in a peaceful manner, and one which continues to confer upon itself the rolling renewal of its legitimacy by virtue of the democratic nature of its process, but also the democratic nature of its dividend. It's difficult to extract out, therefore, this idea called democracy from the wider construct of what we saw with the emergence of the West. As we know, the monarchical dictatorships which applied prior to the French Revolution and well into the 19th century were not greatly welcoming of the emergence of the democratic franchise. In much of Europe, we saw, in fact, an unholy alliance between throne and altar in the case of the Catholic Church. I can say this comfortably as a practicing Roman Catholic, whereby the Catholic Church sought to strangle democracy at birth through one encyclical after the other, often in consort with the monarchies of Catholic Europe and wider Europe at the time. But slowly but surely, the intrinsic notion of the intrinsic worth of a human being, not simply in terms of their membership of the kingdom of God to come, but of the kingdom on earth as well, began to take root. We see also the emergence and the reinforcement of the idea, not just of the intrinsic dignity of humankind, but also of individuals working out their futures with their own individual fear and trembling, rather than it simply being predestined by God above. Very much the enlightening spirit or the enlivening spirit of what we now call, blithely, the Protestant Reformation. And rather than being handed our futures down by a priest from the pulpit, the reformers said, discover your own salvation through your own efforts, through sola scriptura, understanding the scriptures, through your own individually informed human conscience, and through your own individual exercises of intellect, reason, and faith. But to say that the rise of the Protestant Reformation spontaneously combusted in what we would call anything approaching a contemporary democracy is a far-fetched idea. But if you look at the antecedents to the ideas, you begin to see their resonance. Tudor England was no more democratic than its authoritarian Catholic counterparts across the English Channel. But then as we see the widening of the Western project, the widening of the Western civilizational project to include the arms of, let's call it, secular science, the rise of empiricism with Hume and the rest, the rise of Cartesian rationalism, their formal incorporations into the academy, their flourishing in institutions like this, and their counterparts across the world. Again, the notion that truth could be objectively discovered and independently and individually the subject of discourse in the absence of some divine revelation or monarchical bestowal from above, again began to take root. My overall thesis to you is simply that the democratic idea comes out of these quite strong, deep-rooted civilizational developments over several hundred years. I would contend through the idea of the intrinsic dignity of human beings, through the notion of the Protestant Reformation and the role of the individual and their own search for their own future through good conscience, and through, again, the scientific enlightenment, the new tools of the discovery of truth. But even these, through the enlightenment, through the late 18th century and into the 19th century, did not spontaneously combust into what we would call a liberal democracy. That took the separate agency of men at that time in order to extend the franchise. Did they do it through pure virtue, based on the accumulated effect of these civilizational trends over time? I cannot answer that. What I can say is that they were certainly mindful of where unrelenting monarchical despotism was going to land you, for which the principal case study again lay across the French Channel, the English Channel, and what unfolded with the French Revolution. But my overall point is that the idea of democracy as a Western construct has deep Western civilizational origins, each washing through over the course of centuries until we finally had the extension of the democratic franchise through the 19th century, completing itself not through until the midpoint of the 20th century. And again, very recent in the history of humankind. My overall point, therefore, is given the complexity of the origins of this thing called a democracy, given its relative recency, and the fact that it has been, from its origins, a fragile project which in some societies did not take root in the West for a long time, it's important for our generation afresh to remind ourselves that this thing, this idea of the West, this idea of rights, this idea of democratic rights, is something which we should not casually just cast to one side, as if it is some luxurious artifice of a 21st century postmodern society. Our predecessors who have fought at the barricades for this would have a different conclusion. And those of us who therefore look at the fragility of the contemporary democratic project, I believe, have a moral responsibility to again join the barricades in a different form to defend the idea while still modernising its practice. It is not something which we should simply cast to one side as if this was simply a period in history from which we can simply learn and improve to go beyond it. The forms of democracy may improve, but the essence of the idea, which is the inherent dignity of all humankind, expressed equally through a democratic franchise, I believe, must be preserved. If that is the idea, then what therefore is the subject, what therefore is bringing about this wholesale assault on its integrity in so many of the democracies around the world today? There are many such factors at work, many indeed. I think it's worth, however, standing back from the tumult of it all and asking ourselves, what is at work? In my experience as a democratic practitioner, one of the core elements of an effectively functioning democratic system are rules which the country at large, or the democracy at large, regard to be universally fair. There are two enormous structural challenges to the perceived fairness of the contemporary American democracy. I now live in the United States. I've lived there now for several years. And where the American democracy goes has an effect on all of our democracies around the world, whether we like it or not. Our American friends may be deluded when they describe themselves as the world's oldest democracy. Let's not enlighten them on that subject. It would cause too much offence around the dinner table. But the bottom line is this. Were the American democracy to begin to crumble, the idea of democracy itself elsewhere in the world would also begin to shatter and fall. As I observe the American democracy up close, the two essential cancers which are at work within it are to do with unrestricted campaign finance and are to do also with the nature of the American redistricting system. These are essays in political abuse. Each one of them. And each of them has been at work for a long period of time. For those of you who have not followed the decisions of the United States Supreme Court in recent years, the decision several years ago which allows effectively unrestricted campaign finance to flow to any individual campaign anywhere in the United States for any candidate, therefore means that the American democracy has become increasingly for sale and perceived as such. Perceived as such by those who are not the beneficiaries of the decisions which the demos then takes on their collective behalf. On the redistricting question, for those of us who live in this country, the United Kingdom, or in my own country, Australia, the idea of entrusting the crafting of electoral boundaries to the state legislatures of your country, whatever their political composition, is farcical. In my country, it would not last 30 seconds. The idea that you should give to a bunch of politicians from either your own political party or the other side of politics who happened at that stage to run the legislature and the government of that particular state the power to draw the electoral boundaries for the federal electoral districts of the United States House of Representatives is stark raving mad. Yet that is what's happened. And those of us in our political science days have read of the history of Governor Gerry in Massachusetts and have seen the remarkable creativity he applied in the 19th century in beginning to define the outline of then electorates within the Massachusetts State House. He was a rank amateur compared with what has now unfolded. The fact is that while the individual districts of the United States House of Representatives may have the same number of electors as that is mandated, the construction of communities of interest by those who draw the lines, namely the individual legislatures, is frankly an exercising in rolling partisan corruption, designing to corral the vote, either Republican or Democrat. And so when you see the individual analysis of all 50 states of the Union and those constituencies now or electoral districts, which can be defined as safe Republican or safe Democrat, they now represent virtually 85% plus of the seats on offer or the districts on offer in any given House of Representatives election. Those which we would argue are genuinely contestable, that is, open to the impact of those of no particular political affiliation, what we would call in the United States swing voters, in Australia swinging voters, what you might call undecided voters, frankly have now an effect in the margins of a small number of the seats on offer in the United States Congress. Put these two factors together then, the enormous machine called unrestricted campaign finance bears down on the United States Congress and as a result is deployed in these electorates in order to sway the outcome to the greatest extent possible. There's one other factor as well, which you'll be familiar with, which is this reality has another unintended consequence. By virtue of the concentration of safe districts in each of the states of the United States, what you then have are party activists, either to the Republican right extreme or the Liberal Democratic left extreme, controlling their respective party machines in order to secure their pre-selection, their candidatures, their primaries, in order to represent those safe, secure districts for the future. The consequence of that in turn is that you end up with those of the extreme Republican right or those of the liberal left now commanding an increasingly large number of the seats on offer in the United States House of Representatives. And the consequence of that is when people speak of the breakdown of bipartisanship in American politics, there are structural reasons for these things happening, and this is one of them. Therefore, this deep structural cancer affecting the health of the American democracy is something upon which we should all reflect. A second cancer affecting our democracy concerns the actual nature of truth itself. As I said before, the notion that we can, through a civic and civil polity, debate, discuss, and deliberate on different propositions for what should constitute the laws of the country or the state or the region or the province, rests on one thing, which is not just that which I believe in, but how can I prove the proposition that this piece of legislation, that this particular piece of public policy is going to deliver the benefits or the disbenefits that either I or my opponents contend that it does. And that in turn rests on something we would call evidence, evidence-based policy. And that is a factual debate about something called facts, about something called a dear pre-postmodern construction called the objective truth. And what I have sensed, and I think those of us who have been practitioners in politics have sensed over the last 10, 20 to 30 years, is the steady erosion of this idea that a proposition in the public political space can now effectively be considered, debated, analysed, deconstructed against rational criteria or empirical criteria which cause that proposition to be able to be proved or not. If policy A says it's going to deliver dividend B to region C, then this is an evidentiary matter and should be subject to the discourse and subject then to debate. Debates which then become ones about values as to what you want the polity to do, not about the facts as to whether a given policy proposition has merit or not in terms of its ability to deliver the goods. But again, partly born in the United States, but now an infection affecting all of our democracies, is the assault on the notion of objective truth itself. We see this most famously with the Trumpster in the United States, the President of the United States, Donald J. And the idea that we should now have facts and alternative facts, the idea that truth or objective truth is no longer a measurable proposition in the public square through forms of evidence, or what we'd call more quaintly in recent decades fact-checking, is part of the cancer which is unfolding in the body politic in the United States. Trump's proposition, but he simply represents a long-term wave in American politics which has been at work on this for some time, is ultimately to fuse two domains, fact and opinion, as if these simply constitute one part of the same reality. We don't have to be graduates in epistemology to understand that questions of truth are contestable, that questions of fact are contestable, and certainly matters of opinion are contestable, and certainly deep belief in values are ultimately debatable, if not inherently contestable, because they are beliefs in values. But when we simply lose and cut off the end of the democratic process the idea that policy propositions themselves can be detached from factual contestation as if this is somehow an old-fashioned idea and that it is simply my opinion being as good as your opinion, whatever the factual proposition or the factual basis to my opinion or your opinion might be, we then enter onto a very dangerous slope indeed. Trump represents in that respect the high watermark of a trend emerging in American politics, or what most people I think in this room would probably describe as a low watermark in the trend in politics over some time, the nature of truth itself. This leads to, I think, a third cancer alive in the democracy, which the observation I take from the Jesuits rather than anybody else. The recently retired general of the Jesuit order in Rome said the following about the state of the world today. I always love it when we can ask Jesuits the question, what's wrong with the world today? And after a 2-minute reflection, they will give you a wonderfully synthesized answer. Sometimes you'll agree with it and other times not. But the response I got, and since I've subsequently seen read, is this. I've seen put into the public debate by him is as follows. Given where we've got to with the slow and steady erosion of what might constitute measurable fact by empirical methods or a contestable reason through the normal disciplines of rational discourse and what we describe as Cartesian logic, or even commonly accepted deep beliefs about the intrinsic dignity of humankind coming out of deeper religious traditions of the past. His observation is that the principal challenge we face today in our contemporary democracies is what he describes as the globalization of superficiality. It's an elegant phrase. Only the Jesuits could come up with it. But it says something, I think, about the state of our demos, our collective demos across the world. That when I look at the House of Commons, I look at the Australian House of Representatives, I look at the American Congress, there is almost an unwritten rule, which is that the more superficial you can become, the more attention you'll get, and the more likely you are, therefore, to prevail in the public political space. The reverse also applies. When nerds arrive into the public political sphere and they wish to engage on fundamental questions of belief, of opinion, of fact, of evidence-based policy, then that is just not sufficiently entertaining to rank even a marginal mention in the 6 o'clock news or even less in social media. The globalization of superficiality, which is, I think, a deep sociological trend across many of our communities over a long period of time, perhaps augmented by the emergence of mass media more than a generation and a half ago, is nonetheless part of the cancer that we face. Our inability to have about ourselves in a collective polity an attention span long enough to wrestle with the complexity of a challenge of today, for example, on climate change and what to do about it, says everything about an underlying human condition. And if that is alive in the society at large, you then proceed to have elected to our various democratic legislatures people whose fundamental requirement is occasionally to inform, occasionally to lead, but primarily to entertain. And someone who's been in our parliament, let me tell you, if you're not into the entertainment business, then it's hard to prevail. They're always looking for someone who is capable of taking the grab for the 6 o'clock news, which is most likely to cause people to either cringe in horror or shriek with laughter, as opposed to enlighten the public discourse on something which is fundamental to us all. A third cancer. The fourth is related, and that is the decline of what I describe as the public commons. Let's assume that we didn't have the globalisation of superficiality. Let's assume that we still had the common platform let's assume we still had a common view about what constituted objective truth or what constituted a universally rational proposition. If we don't have a public commons on through which these can be debated and discussed, then we cannot prevail as an effectively informed civil polity. The central role of the mass media in this for generations has been pivotal. In this country, you've had scandals related to the concentration of power in the hands of the Murdoch media and of the abuse of that power by the Murdoch media. My observation as an Australian, and having observed Rupert Murdoch at work both in this country and in the United States with Fox News and in Australia, where he owns 70% of the print media, is that it has been one of the most destructive forces at work in destroying the effective public commons for collective discourse on what democracies can and could do. The concentration of media power and the rank abuse of media power has, of course, been a long problem in many of our democracies. But its concentration in these three countries, led by the United States and then here in the UK, and less so in Australia, I think actually has had a profound effect on the nature of the democratic discourse. There's a hypothetical which we should contemplate. Were it not for the Murdoch media and were it not for the Sun, where would the Brexit debate have gone despite Boris? Effectively, the Sun became the mouthpiece of this campaign, the platform through which the Brexit campaign was given daily articulation in working class areas right across this country. And that is because people like Murdoch have always seen the European Union as a problem as it affects his particular definition of liberal capitalism. He fundamentally opposed the regulatory regime which Brussels and his perception represented. He did not want to see the further Europeanisation of British politics, and he would throw, therefore, every resource through his ownership of the public commons here in order to ensure that the Brexiteer message of a combination of Boris Johnson and the chap who used to lead UKIP, whose name is now, thankfully, now escaped me. No one remind me. Says something about the want of responsibility on those who've controlled the public commons in the mass media in this country and other mature democracies. But the more general point, beyond what has been a problem for some time about media concentration and the abuse of mass media power, has been the eruption of social media itself. When you have Murdoch in one corner and Facebook in the other, what do you end up with in terms of the future of our political commons? Something which is indeed very fractured indeed. Of course, the nature of social media has been to provide 100 flowers to bloom and 100 schools of thought to contend. There is something in the idea of Facebook and the social media revolution, platforms which I have used a lot in my public political life, which was inherently emancipating. Immensely delivering of the possibility of I having my individual voice as an individual citizen rather than having to have that voice intermediated by the likes of Rupert Murdoch and his control of a particular mass media organ. And so that's why I've been an enormous fan of social media since it first entered general politics more than a decade ago. And those of you who have followed anything of what I've done in Australia would know that I've done that and been one of the earliest adopters. But when I look a decade later and I see Murdoch in one corner and I see Facebook in the other and Zuckerberg, I'm not quite sure where we land in terms of the future health of our public commons. If we do not have a common public platform to discuss, to debate and deliberate the policy questions of the day, assuming we can deal with the questions of what is truth, assuming we can separate out fact from opinion, assuming we can avoid the globalization of superficiality and bring to the public focus those things which matter, you must have a public platform through which these things are deliberated. And that public platform has been skewed in one direction by the likes of Murdoch and atomized in another direction by the likes of Zuckerberg and Facebook. And of course, finally, the United States Congress has sought to act by bringing Zuckerberg to book, with what net effect, I still do not know. And I still don't know whether he's accepted yet the invitation to appear before the House of Commons. I hope he does. The final cancer, which I'd like to refer to in this presentation this evening, before we open our discussion this evening to your questions, is the fragility and the fracturing of what I would describe as a social and economic contract. This is not simply the preserve of old-fashioned social democrats like myself. It's a deep question about how you ensure that everyone has a stake in the democracy as it unfolds. That everyone, whether they are winners and losers or losers in the great capitalist race, is treated with dignity and respect, with a minimum of equality of opportunity and with a minimum of equality of outcome, so that decency in society is preserved and all people have a stake in the continuation of a peaceful, fair and stable community. There is something about that which I observe in the United States has begun to crack quite some time ago. And if you want to know which way they voted last time round, they all voted for a guy called Trump. Because when people have no longer any hope in what was once delivered through the social contract or the social and economic contract, in terms of a decent welfare net, in terms of decent minimum wages, in terms of decent working conditions, and a decent opportunity for social mobility within their own countries, then anger and rage are the emotions which take their place. And we've seen that writ large in the results that we saw in the presidential elections across the United States in November of 2016. Of course, the power of demagogues is to walk in and to say people to people who have no hope and who have their lives being fractured before them with or without the benefit of opioids, is to say, I will stand up for you against them. Of course, it's a lie. I've not seen one element yet of the Trumpian political project which stands up effectively for them, that is, those who voted for Trump, against those who currently hold the reins of social and economic power in the United States. Thus far, it's been a rhetorical exercise. But I ask myself this question: if the social contract is not repaired, and if Trump and his ilk do not deliver, what then happens when we face further elections with this increasingly angry large number of people who are looking for political outcomes elsewhere? In the United States, in a voluntary voting system, do they simply disappear from the political landscape? Or does political violence become the alternative, as we've seen from so many communities of black Americans over a long period of time where there has been no hope? Therefore, part of the solution for the future lies in the necessary repairs to be done to the social contract. You'd be surprised, given the French origins of the term, that it is now part of the semi-weekly discourse in the United States, of all places, about how to repair their democracy. What can we do now to rebuild the social contract, to repair it? Because the message is finally getting home for those who care about the democratic project in the United States, that something deep and underpinning of the overall proposition of the liberal democratic project has broken and is in need of repair. So these, my friends, represent what I would describe as five core cancers. The last of them, the fracturing of the social democratic project through the particular form of unrestrained liberal capitalism we've had at work since the Reagan-Thatcher revolution is about to be turbocharged by the next revolution in technology, which unfolds before our eyes at present. The revolution in work, which is occurring through the new technologies we're familiar with, which puts Moore's law on speed in terms of the extent to which the labour substitution effect of new technologies is simply occurring at such a pace and such an intensity that it holds open the prospect that the normal substitution effect of new jobs in other sectors of the economy from those displaced by driverless cars and by new forms of automation, that it just can't keep up. And what we've seen so far with, let's call it, the alienated many who voted for Trump at the end of 16 become, in fact, the alienated majority, full majority. So these then constitute our dilemmas. Let me conclude on this, because I'm conscious of the time and I want to leave at least 20 or 25 minutes for discussion. On the third question I put this evening, which was what then can be done, I would simply say to all people here in the United States, my own country, that for those who are emerging into the public political space for the first time, like the good graduates of this university, the beginning of wisdom is to have faith in the democratic construct from the get-go. But to have about you this wisdom, it's no longer a given. Once again, it's up for grabs. And that once again, it therefore needs to be defended by a fresh generation of those who benefit from the democratic dividend. It's no longer necessarily a permanent part of our futures. If we hold true to the ideals which our forebears fought so hard to secure, then the responsibility for all of us in this room, but in particular those emerging into the public politics of our democracies in the decade ahead, is to reconstitute a basic belief and faith in the importance of democracy itself as the most effective principle, the most equitable principle of politics that is anywhere available in the world today. Opinion polls in the United States, in Australia, and the United Kingdom, insofar as I've read them, show that among people under the age of 35, the natural support for democracy as the best form of government is declining. In the United States, the figure I saw recently in published opinion polling was that 40% of young Americans were happy to see other forms of government be adopted in the future. In my own country, that figure is around 25 to 27%. I can't comment on what it is here in the United Kingdom. But when I say it's no longer a given, I mean it's no longer a given. The structural factors we've discussed, its manifestation in terms of the alienation of young people, I think is there for us all to see. Secondly, in reconstituting the public commons, reining in media monopoly and regulating social media so that there is a fact-checked, independent public commons capable of providing the basis for a mature discussion of the big challenges of the future is, I believe, essential if our democracies are to survive. And the third is this, whether it's the politics of the classical left or the classical right or the reforming centre, that unless a project can be put together in our public politics which rebuilds the social contract so that everyone has a stake in the future and not just some, then the fundamental structural drivers which are currently working against the long-term health of our democracies and the economic and social systems which our democracies have delivered will ultimately cause the democracies themselves to fracture and decay. The word social contract almost feels old-fashioned in contemporary political discourse. When we look at its origins in the literature of the late 17th century, it was revolutionary then. It needs to become revolutionary again if we are to rebuild the heart and the soul and the bone and the sinew of what causes everyone from Appalachia to Oxford to feel, to know and believe that they have a real and living and not just rhetorical stake in a demos and a democratic system which delivers for them. I thank you for your attention. By the way, there's a formal text. You can have a look at it later on if you want.
Our speaker's happy to take some questions.
answer the recent election in Malaysia and give some hope that democracy, genuine democracy, is establishing itself firmly in the minds of people in that part of the world? And secondly, the dilemma that many of us face is that here in Britain we had a referendum and it went one way. Whether it was factually, you talked about facts, many of us feel the facts were not sufficient that people could make a choice. And yet our politicians genuinely and rightly do not easily overturn the democratic review in their, what they say. How do we get out of that situation? Is it only through a second referendum or is there some other way?
Thank you for your questions. Firstly, on the state of democracy in Asia, that I think is the question for the 21st century. Asia already has begun to dominate the global economy. Therefore, what Asia chooses through the various nations which make up that vast continent for their political systems and how durable they are will affect the future of democracy. It's no longer just how we choose to think about this in what we loosely call the collective West. If you look at the run of the board, it's not as bad as we think, perhaps. Japan is a functioning democracy. The Republic of Korea is a functioning democracy. Taiwan is a functioning democracy. The Philippines is the Philippines. But it's produced a democratic outcome. Then if you look to Indonesia, which until 20 years ago was a military dictatorship, it is now a functioning democracy. And then as we move through Southeast Asia, we have different forms and levels of, that I say, freedom of democratic expression. And then, of course, we end up with Mother India, but also, frankly, Bangladesh, Pakistan. So the state of the democratic house across Asia is not as bad as perhaps many would assume. But it is under challenge. My good friend, the former president of Indonesia, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, established the Bali Forum on Asian Democracy. It was quite interesting as he chaired that each year, and he would ask me to come when I was in office, as he brought together heads of government from around the region to discuss the health of their own democracies. On Malaysia, the great thing about the democratic outcome there, even though I've not historically been a huge fan of Dr. Mohamed Mahathir, Mahathir Mohamed, has been that you have, for the first time, a pan-ethnic coalition of Muslims and of Christians and of Malays and of Chinese, united about one thing, which is how do you deal with the cancer of corruption, which was killing their democracy in their view. And so this result, which was predicted by nobody, says something about the health of the democratic system and, frankly, the fact that Prime Minister Najib chose peacefully to stand down. More broadly, on the Brexit question, which you asked before, yeah, I mean, this country is a robust democracy. Despite the fact that Boris and his big red bus, aided and abetted by the Murdoch media, was able to convince everybody in this country their sacred freedoms from Runnymede on the Thames were about to be consumed by a vast Brussels bureaucracy, resulting in the vote which you then saw, was had ultimately through a democratic franchise. And so it must be undone by democratic expression of the people's will as well. How is that done mechanically? British politicians would give you a better answer on that. But if the question ultimately goes back to the Commons and it's voted down, or at least not passed, then the opportunity presents itself to be represented to the British people. What would be the basis for so doing it? That the government, having been informed by the British public that they wanted Brexit, came up with a formula for Brexit which the Parliament couldn't agree with, and it was time, therefore, to consult the people on whether that formula for Brexit was acceptable or otherwise. Would be how I'd put the question.
To bolster democracy, what should the media be doing instead? For example, what would be the ideal journalistic landscape and what kind of stories might be helpful to issue?
Well, look, it's not for anyone in political practice to tell the media what they should choose to cover or not. But I would say this, the most effective practice I've seen adopted by our equivalent of the BBC in Australia, it's called the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Commission, is a fairly doctrinaire approach to fact-checking, which they've adopted in the last really 5 years or so. So that particularly when election seasons roll around, but even in the absence of that, their capacity to fact-check propositions which are then put into the public debate by whichever side of politics is now developed a reasonable sense of reputation and demonstrated integrity. So my simple argument would be it is critical, I think, in all of our democracies to have an institution with its own inherent credibility, which it will have to develop over time, in the business of independently fact-checking what people from the political class have to say. Also fact-checking what they and the rest of the media have to say as well. Remember, the public political space is not just made up of the likes of me and those who might oppose me in politics. It's made up of the voices which carry the commentary and carry the opinion leaders and then carry the news reporting across the full panoply of the media itself. In other words, the media needs to self-fact-check in order that we are all kept honest in what occurs. And then, of course, the final discipline which must be applied is for that fact-checking to apply to the social media platforms as well.
Do you think that whole kind of cancer of the modern media, especially in the UK, sets a dangerous precedent in removing the agency of the individual to make their own decision, given the variety of other media sources around?
I'm sorry, the middle bit I missed.
Does it set a dangerous precedent for the individual to not be able to make up their mind?
We had it within our powers for the Australian Parliament to ban the Murdoch media. We chose not to because that's what fascist states do. We chose not to. Therefore, what is required is not the banning or the circumscribing of a free media. What is required is for the institutions of media regulation on the question of facts to be properly functioning. Where Australia offers a very poor example is what we describe, I think, as the Media Complaints Tribunal, whereby when an error of fact is made against an individual or institution, a complaint is made. It's universal practice, this is Complaints Tribunal, which is made up of editors across the newspaper industry and from the major television outlets, is to look after themselves. The findings in favour of Joe Public as having been badly done by a media outlet on a question of fact are very few indeed. In other words, they act a bit like elements of the medical profession. They just look after themselves as opposed to throw themselves open to what I describe as full, independent and continuing scrutiny. I think it is that which keeps the media honest for the future and keeps, I think, the political process honest in the future rather than draconian decisions about banning one outlet or another or make it impossible for them to operate. But my final point is, if there is an excessive concentration of media ownership, then you end up with the private sector equivalent of Pravda or Izvestia in the old days. And frankly, that serves nobody's interest. It's the preservation through law of a diversity of platforms and a diversity of views, plus the rolling, I think, ability to test independently the factual nature of what's been said.
First of all, thank you very much for that talk. I found it very interesting, especially the part where you spoke about the restructuring of voting districts as being sort of inherently corrupt and against the political practice, which is very ironic because liberal media today put Mr. Macron on a pedestal, and yet he's doing exactly the same thing in France. But my question could be a very simple question to answer, because it's about a time where I wasn't alive, and you were, so you might be able to just...
I don't know, mate, how old are you?
I'm 20.
Okay, yeah, I'm just a little bit older than that.
Exactly. But I was wondering how... You spoke about the political arena and political debate between voters. And I was wondering, has that been glamorised basically. Do we sort of look back on these days now that we're living in this era of fake news and think, oh, back in those days there was so much political debate going on between voters all the time, whereas realistically wasn't there just a lot more sort of community-linked debate, community-linked voting, voting how your family voted, how your parents voted, and isn't what we're seeing with social media now just a continuation of that? It's just the same bubble but online.
Except that community-led politics in those days had about them something called geography. These do not. And so when community-level politics in the Mesolithic period, when I began my career, Rick's a Paleolith, I'm a Mesolith, so is that eventually that would translate itself into local civic institutions, which then had local debates, which usually were a non-partisan nature about how you developed a community. I grew up in a town of 160 people in rural Australia. It had a progress association, as it was quaintly called in those days. It had a school of arts. It had a whole bunch of other social institutions of which Robert Putnam would be proud. The Country Women's Association of Australia. Now, these sort of institutions were the platforms through which discussion occurred, frankly, almost like a 20th century replication of the Athenian demos, because it was, when you've got a few hundred people, you're almost at the magical 500, which was supposedly the model for Plato's Republic. So the difference is that these things had about them a local geography. Social media does not. People, and I think social media, when you can add the truth factor, objectively tested, and subtract from it through appropriate technological safeguards, cyber attacks of the sort that we've seen from various authoritarian states, has this enormous capacity to build new communities. But can those new communities create a common consciousness to construct things positively in their polities? Perhaps if it can create a new global consciousness, so this gets on to a slightly more abstract line of thought, among your generation, which says actually what we want is a world without borders in the future, and this is our platform for creating that consciousness, that's all to the good. But the essential difference between the examples you referred to historically and that is the question of the immediacy of the geography and the community affected.
We're listening to you because we want to protect the project of democracy. Let's assume for a moment we fail, and what would be
we should buck up first.
What would be the first thing, the first signal, the first thing to give, and where would you see a point of no return?
That's a particularly acute question. Two-part answer to it. The first is, assuming we fail. Can I add one other thought, which doesn't come from the Jesuits, but comes from the professor of positive psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, a guy called Martin Seligman, who's a good friend of mine. He says in his reflections that one of the greatest malaises in the way in which we deal with national politics, international politics in the 21st century, is the growing phenomenon of learned helplessness. That is, we conclude deeply psychologically that these problems of the type we've been discussing with the state of the democracy are so profound, so pervasive, so systemic, so large, that none of us can do anything about it. We're all hapless recipients of the inexorable onward march of negative historical forces, which are going to blow us to bits. He argues to the contrary. So part of what I do around the world is say, let's not have about us a culture of learned helplessness as if these things can't be dealt with. Now, I know you're not saying that, but I feel that I need to add that as the first part of the answer. Secondly, in terms of things falling apart, I think it is when you begin to see a complete collapse of voter turnout, by which I mean, let's just say the Trump presidency fails to deliver to the people he voted for. And let's just say that those folks become so alienated that they simply retreat from the political process altogether, and that retreat now occurs in larger and larger numbers as the few in their remaining communities in Appalachia can no longer get jobs as driver of long-haul vehicles across the United States because they're now all driverless cars. It's when you start having the voter non-turnout in excess of 50% and growing that I think that becomes the earliest harbinger of the system cracking, because these folk no longer believe they have any effective voice. And if you know anything about the rise of democracy in the first place, in the history of the French Revolution, the revolutions of 1830 and 1848, the violence that was associated with those events came from people who saw they had no political outlet that was effective. And in the case of the French, the Estates General did not answer for le peuple.
Mr. Rudd, to what extent do you think compulsory voting in Australia protected Australia from some of the cancers you spoke about? And do you think it provides, or it could be any part of any solution to the building of the social construct, assuming that any kind of benefit would make it?
I would have been much more in favour of compulsory voting had I won the last election. But I didn't, so there's obviously a problem with the system rather than... let me rethink about that. I think the value of compulsory voting is this. One, as applied to the United States, it helps with corruption. What do I mean? Because if you ask anyone who's running a campaign, I've got friends running for office for the current congressional midterms, gubernatorial races and congressional races are right across the country. The amount of cash these guys have to raise to turn the vote out, as opposed to just advertise, is huge. Therefore, if our primary concern is the cancer which fundraising represents, then compulsory voting helps with that. I think its second way of helping is in answer to the question I was just asked, which is how do you guarantee against people walking outside the process altogether? I think the voter turnout in Australia under compulsory voting is about 96%. We fine people if they don't vote. I think the fine's now $200 or so, so it's not trivial. You get lots of donkey votes. I mean, that's how I first got elected, mate. So, and you know, people can spoil their ballot paper. The thing is to force folk into the polling booth to make a decision at the end of the day. And as a citizen of the Australian Commonwealth, I mean, my view is this is a good thing, including our actual voting system itself, which is different to yours. You have first past the post voting. We have what we call compulsory preferential voting. There are 10 candidates. We make you number them 1 to 10. Who do you like most and who do you hate least? And the whole idea is to force you into a position that if you're just going to go in there and vote for the stark raving loony party, we still require you to say, OK, when it gets down to number 9, who can you tolerate most or least out of this bundle of human beings? So I think there's something to be said for that as well. Final point is, spontaneously in the current angst of the American public debate about their own political system, I find to my complete amazement that there is now a discussion about compulsory voting in the United States. It has historically been seen as such an enormous assault on civil liberties that they would rather die with their gun in hand, right to bear arms and their right not to vote, than to ever yield to such ideas.
I was wondering, what kind of threat to democracy in a country like India, and is it even feasible to have democracy in such a diverse country, in such a large country, I guess? Is it too unstable, do you think?
Well, let me put to you the alternative prospect. And we have a colleague from China here, and China's what I know best because I'm a sinologist by training. I'm just a practitioner in the democratic, in the business of democracy. In the great and eternal debate of China v. India, China, successful, builds infrastructure, raises living standards, escapes from poverty, last 30 years, 600 million people plus out of poverty, 80 million to go. People now have a high degree of freedom in their individual lifestyles, zero freedom in politics. That's essentially the Chinese contract. Plus, a high degree of state-owned ownership in industry and state regulation of private firms. India, world's biggest democracy, caste system alive and well, poverty of the 1.3 billion Indian people still running at about 600 million plus, I think. Every Tuesday morning there's some state election somewhere across that vast continent involving 67 political parties most of us have never heard of before or have heard of each other before. Yet, since independence, despite Mountbatten's, I think, appalling decision to split the country, side point, no fundamental military coup. Indira Gandhi got a bit close. And secondly, at least in the last decade or so, average annual growth of about 6-7% against a Chinese norm in a similar period of development of about 10-13%. Now, the essential weakness of the Chinese system is that they don't know how to handle political transition. That's it. Since the birth of the People's Republic, with Mao's death in 1976, up until that time we'd had a cultural revolution, which was effectively a domestic political purge of all of Mao's political opponents, all of whom were killed in one form or another, or sent to the countryside, and some of whom died of mistreatment. Others were eventually slowly rehabilitated. When he died, you then had a military coup against the Gang of Four. And then 2 years later, you had another coup against the remnants of the Gang of Four. Then you had the events of 1989, which led to the purge of Zhao Ziyang. And then, following that, you've had some difficult events, including the most recent leadership transition to Xi Jinping, including a number of reports of a considerable attempted coup against him in 2013-14, which has not made much appearance in international news media. So the huge downside of the Chinese political system is it does not have the political shock absorbers which elections represent in democracies. It is left to an oligarchy, effectively, to decide among themselves whether there's sufficient commonality of interest within the oligarchy and a monolithic party to agree on this slate of candidates for the future. Deng Xiaoping tried to regularise that with his reform starting from 1978 on, only after, however, a coup had been organised against those who had conducted a coup against him in 1966 and then again in 1971 and 73. So there is a problematic element to the alternative. So you all know what Churchill had to say about democracies. So I kind of have a similar view to Churchill's.
My question is, do you think China is currently ready for democracy, and what do you think is good for a transition to democracy in China?
Because the line taken by various Chinese leaders is that it's alien to we Chinese political tradition. And you know something? They're right. There's nothing in the Chinese tradition which is faintly democratic. Go to the imperial period, ain't there. Look at the early republican period, not really. Go to the later republican period under Chiang Kai-shek, an early attempt, largely subverted by a combination of KMT corruption plus the Japanese invasion. And then you had Chinese Communist Party takeover. So the equivalent of what you would describe as everything from the French Revolution through the revolutions of 1830 and 1848 in Europe, and then the subsequent working class movements of the 1870s, 80s and 90s, giving rise to the German Social Democrats, the British Labour Party, the extension of the democratic franchise to working people, the rise of trade union movements. There has not been much of that in the modern Chinese tradition, and none of it in the classical Chinese tradition. The classical Chinese tradition, though, has one key standout element, and that is a celebration, as you know, of the right to, but almost the moral imperative, to dissent against the emperor if the emperor was taking a crazy decision. Of course, that usually meant that was the end of you as the official. Once you'd done the noble thing, presented your imperial petition, dear emperor, you are wonderful, you are the son of heaven, I love your dress, you're a keen fella, but I think this policy is nuts. Yours sincerely, in the tradition of the independent Confucian scholar class. These are all celebrated, as you know, in Chinese history. Very few of them actually survived. That's why they're celebrated. But apart from that, there ain't much, and certainly nothing systemic about what we'd call Minzhu, which is a 20th century term, or even Renchen, which is a 20th century translated term. But we're now in the 21st century, and the one huge problem for the Chinese classical reservation against the inapplicability of liberal democracy to the Chinese tradition is Taiwan. Now, Taiwan is a country of only 23 million people, but, you know, it's the full inheritor of the entire civilizational baggage / tradition of China. And therefore, knowing Taiwanese military leaders, and I knew a few of them because I studied there as a kid, the pre-Mesolithic period, these guys ran the same arguments, whether it was Chiang Kai-shek or the early period of Jiang Jingguo in the mid to late 70s. But then, through the 80s, you began to see a discourse emerging in Taiwan. Well, hang on, this need not necessarily be so. And then you get to the 90s, and you begin to see, of course, the first experimentations with the abolition of martial law, I think, in 87, and then the introduction of parliamentary elections. And despite the fact that Taiwan is a freewheeling, raucous, partly corrupt, political system, but I don't think any more corrupt, frankly, than the United States, given the scale of campaign contributions in the US. You know, the Taiwanese economy continues to perform reasonably well. If you go, it's the first country in Asia to not just decriminalise homosexuality, but to legislate in support of marriage equality. This has become the liberal heartland of Asia, actually. It is a fascinating place to be, and it has a robust sense of itself. Taiwanese old-timers will say it's lost its martial spirit. They're right. This presents a separate set of national security concerns in terms of how Taiwan secures its future against any future move by the PRC to take Taiwan by military means. But it is the huge case study. And I think that's what gives our friends in Beijing a lot of angst about the future success or otherwise of the Taiwanese model.
Well, a good performance indicator of the success of the talk is the number of people who, at the end of the question period, are putting their hands in the air and wanting to break in. And by that standard, this has been a fabulously successful talk. And indeed, I think it's not just the performance indicator, because we've had a wonderful sweep. I mean, leaving aside the Mesolithic period, apart from the chronological apart from the chronological sweep, the geographical sweep has been dazzling. I think there are not many parts of the world that haven't been productively mentioned, and throughout it all, we've had this concentration on the subject of the talk, that is the viability and the future of democracy. And it's been a wonderful combination, I think, of a terrific learning, also quite a lot of disarming humor.
We Australians take ourselves very seriously, Rick.
And a very nice combination of the thinker, the wisdom of the thinker and the wisdom of the practitioner. Altogether, I think it's a wonderful dress rehearsal for your transfer of status examination tomorrow. So I suspect if you need it, which I don't think you will, you can probably get 100 or so signatures urging your candidacy tomorrow. But seriously, Kevin, we're tremendously grateful to you. It's been a really enlightening experience. Thank you very much.
Thank you.